This is February the 23rd, 2006, and I am going to be reminiscing with Richard Stout. Okay, Richard, let's start at the beginning.
I was born in 1934 at the height of the Depression. We survived. My older brother was given piano lessons. I was given violin lessons, and then I was given art lessons starting at the age of 12, a classical drawing from a man named Robert Stapp. There was a small group of us. I learned how to render in charcoal. Right away, I became very involved with the new Beaumont Museum that was run by Wafy Hoffman and V.C. Rainwater. And also at that time, I met David and Pat Cargill, who had just returned from graduate school at Cranbrook, having done their undergraduate work at Pratt. He is a sculptor still living in Beaumont, as is she, a painter. And they're probably David's most recent notable work in Houston are all the sculptures inside the Chapel of St. Basil at St. Thomas University. Through the city schools and very good art teachers, I entered several Scholastic Art Awards contests each year and won lots of awards, keys, and certificates of merit. I was showing and teaching. And then in my junior year in high school, my aunts in Cincinnati, my father's oldest sisters, had me come up to the Cincinnati Art Academy for summer of classes. And the following summer, the summer before, after I graduated from high school, I also went to the Cincinnati Art Academy. That fall, I went to the Art Institute of Chicago on full scholarship, thanks to the Scholastic Art Awards. I stayed on fellowship the entire 4 years I was there.
How old were you then?
I went to the Art Institute when I was 18. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting story about being sent up with a steamer trunk on a train and then having this, 18 years old from Beaumont, Texas. Very funny. My first roommates were also scholarship winners, the painter Jack Beale, who for many years showed with Frumkin Gallery in New York, and Richard Klein, who now lives in Florida. My 4 years at the Art Institute were busy. I had very good teachers. My main interest outside of art was music, and I ushered at Orchestra Hall across the street from the Art Institute. For 3 of the years I was there, so I could hear concerts and Fritz Reiner and all the other good people. I was given a Yale Norfolk Fellowship in my senior year at the Art Institute, and I went off to their summer program, the most distinguished person, although at the time we didn't know that she was the most distinguished person in that class, was Eva Hesse, who currently has a show up at the Menil Collection, wonderful artist. I didn't know where I was going to go after school and after this program in Connecticut, so I arranged to get a Greyhound bus ticket that would allow me to go to several cities, working my way back to Houston, or into Beaumont. I didn't want to consider moving to the West Coast or to the South. The West Coast seemed to be too far away intellectually for me. In the South, I felt nothing would happen there for a very long time. So I knew New York from many trips to New York as a student. I spent time in Boston and Washington and Baltimore and Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Cleveland. I knew Cincinnati. I knew Chicago. I spent time in Milwaukee and Minneapolis. St. Louis, Kansas City, Dallas, and each of these places, and finally Houston, each of these places, checking out the Chamber of Commerce to find out what the per capita tax were, what cost of living was, what new art things were happening that were interesting, would it be a comfortable place to be, what the people were like. And I decided, I'll do this for Houston, even though it's awfully close to home, and I found that Houston was by far the most interesting of the places I'd been. And I went back to Beaumont, had a garage sale and paintings and the like, and raised $400 and moved to Houston with one name, had been given me of someone who might introduce me around, and that was Preston Frazier. Preston Frazier put me up in his warehouse building. He had the candle shop for Roy at the time.
And what year is this again?
This was 1957. Mm-hmm. Henry and Leela Gabois had a party the next night at their house on Bingle Road, the house where their daughter currently lives with her husband. And it was a house built by Robert Prusser, the painter who had just left Houston to join Yuri Kepish at MIT teaching in the painting department there. Robert Prusser, an important abstract painter in Houston from the 30s and 40s. At that party that the Gabois had at their house on Bingle Road at the Bayou, I met about 30 people who would be very close friends for the next several years, including Herb and Abigine Mears and Polly and Lee Marsters, a great long list of people who were artists and collectors, and these were to be my closest friends for a long period of time. Many still are. That was in November of 1957. I quickly found a small apartment in the 1200 block of Bissonnette to rent, a garage apartment, and it was interesting because it was so right in the middle of all of the swell Houston. I could climb my steps to my apartment and look down into the baker's backyard and see all of the young swells of Houston having their martinis from a silver pitcher in the backyard. Very, very, very impressive. You wouldn't see anything like that in Chicago, and not in the part of Chicago I had to live in. I got a job selling books at Foley's downtown. I had a bicycle, so I went everywhere for the first 6-8 months on a bicycle. Lowell Collins at the, thanks to Ruth Euler at the Houston Museum, Lowell Collins at the Houston Museum hired me to, that next summer of 58, start teaching classes at the museum school, which I did, and with an increasingly numbers of classes, so I was able to retire from selling books at the bookstore by the next year, by the spring of 1959. I was able to stop selling books at the bookstore. I had my first show in Houston. I was in a show at the Cushman Gallery. This was Aubrey and Parker Cushman and Lucy Smith. This is Mimi's mother's gallery, the Cushman Gallery. I believe it was on Whitney Street. I was with them briefly and was in a group show there, and then I moved to Catherine Swinson's New Arts Gallery a little bit later on in 1958, and had a show with Catherine Swinson at the New Arts Gallery in 1959.
Where was her gallery?
It is still existing. It is on the just one block north of Elgin at Brazos. It's the tall tower that was the apartment, was the tall tower of the gallery. The gallery, the New Arts, had an address on Brazos. I can't remember the address right now. It was the swellest gallery in Texas by far. And Lynn Stetter had designed the building. It was a coach house for a mansion that had been destroyed, and coach house designed for the architectural offices on this, below, on the extension to the coach house were the drawing rooms. The big room above with the slope ceiling and north facing windows was the gallery, and then next to that was Bailey and Catherine Swinson's residential tower that was on pilots and on concrete piers up mm-hmm. for the first floor with a hanging staircase. A living, dining, kitchen on the first floor, a bedroom, bath on the second floor, and then a roof garden, all connected by a circular staircase. It's still there. It's been very much ruined, and by enclosing the bottom and filling out the third floor with another roof on top of it. But it was the wonderful place to have shows. Guy Johnson showed there, Jack Boynton, Jim Love, Hassel Smith, Walter Kuhlman, a lot of Jerry Maine McCaggie's California people showed there, and it was a branch for a good while of the Andre Emmerich Gallery in New York that said they showed lots of pre-Columbian.
When did she open that gallery?
I think she opened the gallery in 55, maybe 50, early 56, and I joined in 58. And it was about 1960 that she had, I guess, one of her last exhibitions at that gallery was a Dorothy Hood drawing show in maybe 1960 or 61. Dorothy came, then Dorothy went back to Mexico, and then came back like 2 years later in 63. Dorothy was here briefly, I think, in 1960. I left the gallery in 61 because Catherine and Bailey were getting started on the most awful divorce in the world. Jim Love would not support one or the other, so Catherine proceeded to give all of her Jim Love sculpture away. That's how deeply it was felt. I wasn't close to Catherine Swinson in those years. Dick Ray, however, was. Also, the relationship between Catherine Swinson and Germaine McCaggie was interesting in that Catherine, who had been very involved with the Contemporary Arts Museum before, finally found a visual mentor that sort of separated her from the crowd, the other crowd. There was, at this time, in the late 50s, some considerable anger between some of my friends, the Mears, the Gavois, etc., the Marsters, and those people like Catherine, the Sissolses, and a number of other people who were supporters of Germaine McCaggie, who referred to the older group as being the burlappers. That's because they would cover the walls of the institution amateurishly. This was all put down, of course, so they could hang pictures up and not make holes in the wall, that sort of thing. We always forget that the Contemporary Arts Museum was a very successful volunteer organization and had very extraordinarily good and successful exhibitions in the beginning with catalogs. And then when John and Dominique de Manille hired Germaine McCaggie, a brilliant woman, a lot of people felt cut out, even though Germaine McCaggie would hire the various artists and board members to do exhibitions. The older group felt cut out, and so they were very antagonistic towards Germaine McCaggie and everything that she did. This made it a little difficult, you know, for me in the beginning, only because I didn't know how to sort of like step on these two quaking boats. You know, I wanted to be nice to everybody. You know, one of the things I think that I characterize as my entire time in Houston is that, as I was mentioning to a friend the other day, I've never been a part of a clique. I've always just been I am associated with Dick and Lucas and all those people, and there certainly was a time that, you know, Dick and I were spending probably 6 hours a day in each other's company for a year period of a couple of years, when our kids were young and all that sort of thing. But, you know, we kind of laugh about that, how we could have actually done that. Let me see. I met Dick Ray about 1960. I met about 60. Maybe it was 59. It was fairly early. He had just come back from Europe. And I think it was maybe 59. I had a show in Dallas also in 1959. I sold one painting. I took everything. By then I had a car. It was an old DeSoto limousine. And I had racks on top of the car that held a big box that had the paintings in it. Okay. So I took Highway 75 to Dallas to take the show off, sold one painting, and all the way back about 20 miles outside of Houston, the car started going, and I made it back to my little apartment on this and that, and the car died. I took the paintings out, had the car hauled off. those kinds of days. Back to the bicycle. And I can assure you, you didn't make much money those days teaching at the Glassell School, and I had no other job.
Well, now, just real quickly, you had left the Swinson Gallery and had traumatized, and dissolved,
She moved to a place on Avondale and had a couple of shows. The most important one was a show of Rene Delbo. She also had an exhibition at the big gallery, the other gallery, of the small works by Max Ernst. Mm-hmm. When I think now what we could have bought those for, I know it's disgusting. Anyway. And Dick Ray at this time was showing with Joan Crispell at the Louisiana Gallery. Mm-hmm. And by, I guess when he came in 61, I was by this time showing with Meredith Long. I had my first show with him in 63, I believe.
Well, Meredith hadn't been open very long in 61.
It would have been 62, I guess, maybe 62. Mm-hmm. I think 62.
Uh-huh.
I started showing with Meredith. Maybe 62, maybe 63. Right in there.
Uh-huh.
Right in there. He was on Westheimer, right by the railroad tracks. Mm-hmm. In Highland Village. And it was also in the fall of 1960 I bought this house.
I had been
looking with my mom for a house because I told mom, I said, prices are cheap here. I should really buy a house. I don't know what to do. And she says, well, let's look. And so we found some houses up on Mount Vernon, a little bit further north, and they were like $20,000, and they weren't very big. And she says, now, honey, you need to buy size. You know, get space. I had come back from Mexico. This was just before Sweeney, before Sweeney arrived, so I can date that. Lowell Collins and I had taken a trip with art students to Mexico for 2 weeks, and on that trip was Pat Carter and her daughter Patricia Carter, now Winkler, my sister-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back from that trip having picked up a disease, and I got very, very
sick.
Very sick. But I was installing some exhibitions at the Houston Museum. It was the period between Lee Malone and James Sweeney, and they had to install shows in Cullinan Hall. And I installed a couple of shows in Cullinan Hall, and then got quite sick that end of that summer. And then came back from Beaumont to teach my classes in end of August or the beginning of September at the Museum School. And I was in my little apartment at 1202 and a half Bissonnette, which was later Howard Barnstone's office. I think his last architectural office was in that building. And Mom dropped me at my apartment and went off to get some fried chicken or something, and saw this house on the side street and looked around. She said, I want to show you a house. Came over here, looked at it in the moonlight.
Aww.
Talked to the Mrs. Dunn next door, who had lived there all of her life, came back the next day and looked at it better with a realtor, and I bought this house for $11,500. I was able to make a down payment from savings bonds my mother had put away in my father's name, of one-third, the black man that had helped my family in Beaumont for so many years, Eunice Marlborough, came over, and we put in two apartments upstairs with little kitchenettes, and so those two apartments paid for the house.
Wow.
And the utilities and the taxes and the insurance, and the house was completely paid for by 1972.
Smart.
Well, I mean, if you're an artist, you have to do it, because this
smart.
And it was in the part of town I wanted to live.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first rule of anything is being there. You have to be there.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be under here. You have to be out there. You have to be out there somehow. And being in this part of town, close to the museums, I would be closer to people I would be closer to physically and intellectually. And it was the kind of neighborhood I was accustomed to. I grew up in a neighborhood not unlike this in Beaumont.
Mm-hmm.
Then I continued teaching at the Houston Museum School I met Ann Winkler in the spring of 1964, and Meredith by that time was in his new building on San Felipe, and I was painting I was making lots of trips to Mexico at this time, Oaxaca and so on, and a lot of the paintings from this period, a number of which I still have, respond to the mythical quality of the Mexican landscape as I saw it, and because landscape's always been a factor in my work to a certain degree. Oh, I can't remember lots of details, except that I had four dates with Anne, and then I went away to Europe for 4 months. I bit the bullet. I was 29, and I knew if I didn't do it and borrow money, I've never borrowed money in my life, and you know, I figured out that early that it was not a good idea to borrow money, so I lived off of what I had. And so I did borrow money to go to Europe, and I had some contacts there, so I was able to stay with people lots of places. And I took James Chilman's advice to his students that if you go to Europe, spend half your time in Italy. If you go to Europe for one day, spend your morning in Rome. I did. I spent 2 months of that. 4 months in Italy, 3 weeks in Florence, and 3 weeks in Rome, and that was great. And came back, and Anne had, in the meantime, moved more nearby, and we started seeing each other, and within the year we were married. So, and of course, had babies. And when I realized I was going to get married, I went to the University of Houston and asked Dr. Peter Gunther if there might be a position out there, and he said, well, I can take you part-time now, which was 3 classes, which is now considered full-time, and when you get your master's, we will hire you full-time. This is a sort of a gentleman's agreement. I like you. We'll do this. That's fine. It doesn't work that way anymore.
Oh, I know.
It's, you've hired these long list of people and applications and all this frontage of the application forms and the letters and so on and so forth. Anyway, I taught drawing and freshman drawing and painting to a large degree with Bill Anselm, who's a good close friend of mine, and we were both showing with Meredith Law. And Bill and I were very good teaching together because we were a very different kind of method in a way. And was it very different kind of ideas to where you might go with this. And early on, I had interesting students right from the very beginning, and many of whom I still see. And that first year, I was still at the museum school because the director, Lowell Collins, had quit. And so I was running it for a year or 2 years. I can't remember. A year or 2 years. Ruth Euler asked me to do it. And, of course, I did. And it wasn't too much work, but I had to do lots of other things at the same time. And then I had to start working on my master's get my job nailed down at the University of Houston. And so teaching 18 hours at the University of Houston and taking 18 hours at Texas was interesting because I commuted 2 and sometimes 3 times a week to Austin. And I did my principal painting work with Everett Spruce, a lovely, lovely man, a wonderful painter and a lovely human being. And my various academic work with Marion Davies, who was a great star, a great scholar, and worked on papers, which is not my strong suit, and did some things that were okay. And she encouraged me to even clean up more and publish, but it's not my interest. And on a few occasions would take Gunther up with me because he was working on his doctorate at the same time. And on a few occasions, would stop by and visit with Kathleen Blackshear and Ethel Spears in Navasota. Kathleen Blackshear had been my art history teacher at the Art Institute of Chicago and was also my composition teacher, a woman who, a brilliant painter and a wonderful teacher who was the principal person in these areas at the Art Institute of Chicago from the late 20s until her retirement in the mid-60s. I think that I finished all of that work up. I was hired by full-time by in 1968 at the university. My son, Stefan, was born in 1967. My father's two oldest sisters, the ones who had asked me to come to the Art Institute, the Art Academy in Cincinnati when I was a teenager, had retired and moved to stay with my mother in Beaumont. And they were over with my mother at this time and said, well, we have a little bit of money. We could leave it to you, or we could build you a new studio. And I said, well, let's build a new studio. And so we built a studio in the back, $15,000. And they lived many more years, and they saw all of the stuff that came out of the studio, and they were very thrilled about that and very happy about that.
That's wonderful.
And I'm very close to my family. I'm the only surviving heir. My brother and I were the only grandchildren in my father's family. And I'm the youngest of the grandchildren in my mother's family. And unfortunately, many of those have passed on already. My mother died 3 years ago at 96. And so
you're lucky that you have that long, Richard.
I was lucky. I became aware but not absolutely involved with a lot of things that were happening in the art world in Houston by virtue of the fact that I was busy in the art world in Houston, and I couldn't get away to the normal watering holes that other people could get to. Louisiana Gallery was continuing. It was moved to Kipling Street, I believe, and out west. Catherine had reopened the New Arts in an old house on Audubon, and there she showed various people, including Peter Pledgens, I remember, the critic, seeing paintings that he had there. I believe he came to her from the University of Texas, where he was teaching for a couple of years, at least one contract. The David Gallery was brilliant. Run by someone who was very interested in a new way of thinking about visual arts, and opened, this is Diane, opened her arms to possible wonderful things to happen, and possible wonderful things did happen at the David Gallery. In a building designed by Charles Tapley on San Felipe, just a few blocks east of Meredith Long, it was probably the most important scene in Houston at that time. Houston was beginning then to draw some people. It was interesting. People like Lucas and Dorothy from Mexico. We all saw this wonderful, rich importation of material from Mexico, because there's always been a very strong interest in Mexican art in Houston. At the major shows at the Contemporary Arts Museum early on, I think maybe their first show was Diego Rivera, and other exhibitions had that people like Frank and Eleanor Freed had put together Mexican art. And Susan McEnshan's great interest in contemporary Mexican art, which she collected voraciously. Mm-hmm. And I wonder where all that collection is now, she had some extraordinary things. And then, of course, the great Tamayo mural that we no longer have. It's now in Dallas. That's too bad.
Yep.
That's a great sadness, and it was only $4 million. That's a critical aside. I could give you 2 hours on that. The loss of muscle that what happened in this town in the early 80s was the loss of muscle.
Mm-hmm.
Any case, I think the thing that catapulted Houston was when we all realized that we didn't have to take 5 flights to get out of Texas, and that we could actually get on a jet at Hobby even and get to New York in just one flight, instead of having to go to New Orleans on a prop plane or a bus or something like this. We felt as though we could actually get there, and I think that made a big difference. And then Houston was beginning to surface a bit more in the national consciousness in the art world. I recall in 1960 I had friends come down from Chicago, and I was going to meet them in Dallas. I had picked them up from the train in Dallas, and we were going to go around and see things in Dallas and then drive on to Houston. And we were about 40 miles outside of Dallas coming down interstate, coming down Highway 75. And they said, how long is it going to be before we're in Houston? About 5 hours. They couldn't believe it. They said, well, where is Houston? And I said, haven't you ever looked on the map? And I it was, we thought it was close to Dallas. And I said, well, you just thought it was close to Dallas because you've heard about Dallas. Dallas, you've heard about Dallas because of Neiman Marcus. Oh, yes, yes, yes. So we finally got here. And they loved it. And, of course, it's very different. But we began to sort of come up in the consciousness of the country. And as I was would visit with friends in those early years in New York and in Chicago, artist friends, everyone said, you live where in Texas? Mm-hmm. You live in Texas? Where in Texas?
Why?
Why? That's why it's nice, you know. And of course, one of those couples, Jack Beale and his wife Sandra, were on their way back from Mexico and stayed here in 1960 at this house, and it was during the encephalitis scare, and they could hardly wait to get out because there were all these encephalitis mosquitoes around everywhere, and they've never been back to Texas since. All during this time, also in the early 60s, my peer and close friend Richard Hunt, we were at the Art Institute together, was in the Army. This was, you know, late 50s, early 60s, in the Army in Fort Sam, and working as a sculptor in San Antonio and influencing artists there, and would regularly come here, and we would go out, and it was strange. It was just before the color bar went down, and I said, I've got to figure out where we can have lunch. We can go to this great barbecue place on West Gray, and I'm sure we can eat there. No such luck. So we got sandwiches and went out to Memorial Park and had sandwiches in Memorial Park so we could have lunch together. Next year, it was over.
Well, but I was thinking when they had the first sort of sit-in downtown, and it was in, I don't want to call it the Walgreens, what was the drugstore down there? Was it Walgreens?
It was Walgreens.
And the mayor and some others, they all went in together. You remember
that
story?
Yeah, yes, exactly.
And that just did it. And it was very civilized.
Very civilized.
The leadership in Houston.
You absolutely hand it to the leadership in Houston for making that work well. I can't even remember who the mayor was.
It was
Cotrere, probably. It was a cross-racial group of movers and shakers in town that said, "Let's do it this way." Mm-hmm. There was never a problem.
No.
And there hadn't been a problem since.
No.
And so, anyway. Occasionally people would come in and we would treat them well and take them for oysters, but usually people ignored us and I would have to go out and see things. But during the time of the kids, from 67 on, I didn't get to get out very much at all. I didn't get to go to any of the watering holes very much because I had to be here. And the University of Houston paid pitifully. The only really good things that I can say about the University of Houston is that I had wonderful students and was able to have a fairly free hand in teaching them painting, and which I felt I was best at, and did that. And
well, let me ask you just to, if you could go back, because I'd like to capture some of the flavor. And you've given us a lot, but if you could go back to the late 50s, early 60s, mushing on to maybe the early 70s, what was the energy? What was the character of the city from an art standpoint for artists and for collectors?
I think that by the time I got here, there was it was certainly very generous. Anyone could come and do anything, but there was a real attention, at least in my circle, for those things that were unique. When we saw Forest Best, we knew this was unique.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had known that you could have bought a Forrest Best painting for $15, then I would have bought 20. But I thought they were like $200 and $300.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't pull that off. But that's like everything else. You need to ask. I've always been the shy one. I never would ask, you know, because I think I could have maybe had one or two plates less oysters and had a Forrest Best hanging on my wall right now, which would be thrilling. I think that there were the stick-in-the-muds who said, oh, it's got to really be kind of Second School of Paris and decorative.
Mm-hmm.
And David Addix certainly fell into that category and satisfied everyone with his handsome but not very interesting paintings. You know, they politely lined the walls of many houses in Houston and still do. And those people who wanted to see something that would sort of like make them think a little bit more about various things. Louise Ferrari, who had been Jerry's secretary, had a private arrangement here and was particularly close to certain people like Jim and Dick Ray, and would show their work, and had a one big show, a public show on Main Street in the
Wasn't
old...
Wasn't she an art consultant?
She was. And she had a very good eye, and had a very strict idea as to what art was. Out of all of that, all tied together with John and Dominique Dimenil, what was happening at St. Thomas, the print club, once again, where we could have gotten those wonderful things for nothing. And later, the Rice mm-hmm. Episode, and a real attention to a certain kind of avant-garde that is... I think you see in Sweeney, and in particular, this happened in 1961. I think Sweeney came here in 61. I was still at the museum all during this time, and Sweeney needed to have his people around him, and the staff at the museum was very tiny at this time, and so he liked to have large plastered letters on the high up on Cullinan Hall, announcing the show.
Mm-hmm.
So I would arrange the plaster letters and well, let's make those blue. And so I'd paint them blue and get them arranged, and I would have my template, and I'd take it up on the lift. Then I would stick the letters on with contact cement because that's kind of all we had. And I recall the Jean Tingley exhibition. I was there just as everything was, you know, opening up, and Sweeney and Tingley and Niki Sapal were coming in the front door, and two of the letters came off and shimmered to the floor and cracked. Tingley just loved it. the whole party, the whole time to go into, this would have been, 65 or 66, to walk into the Museum of Fine Arts, into Cullinan Hall,
mm-hmm.
this big glass box.
Mm-hmm.
See all these things go jiggling and jangling around, and all the people sort of putting their art in and making the art, you know, the tingly art, and then all of the dancing that went on, and that Niki Sapal and Tingley all went out to the paraded around in the Meekum Fountain in their fancy clothes and such as that. A dance on the back lawn,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was just a lot of fun,
mm-hmm.
a lot of fun. I also recall it was hot. So.
Sure.
But it was high times, high art, really good art. Sweeney left, Mary Buxton Kane did a wonderful job of kind of keeping it going with a wonderful Louise Nevelson show and a couple of others. Soulage, Hartung, I think sort of Catch as Catch Can shows were around, and holding the museum together. Cab Smith, I think, was very important in terms of handling that transition very well. Mimi's.
Was he on the board then?
He was on the board, and which I think was one of the reasons for getting Philippe. They wanted to have someone that had a different kind of credential than Sweeney, because there were a lot of people who Sweeney had inadvertently offended, and And I don't think that he intended to offend. Anyway, Philippe was very smooth and built all that back beautifully. And I liked Philippe a lot. I thought he did a wonderful job. I thought every one of our directors have done wonderful jobs for the museum. I got my grandson some interesting things on Rube Goldberg drawings and so on and so forth. And I saw this on Amazon.com, so I picked up Peter Marzio's
graduate book.
Well, yes, it was his doctoral dissertation, yeah, mm-hmm. on Rube Goldberg. I haven't started it yet.
How fun.
I think the world of Peter. I think he's terrific. He's done a great job. In the early 70s, to kind of bring this up to date, I guess the mid-70s, the Blacker Gallery opened at the University of Houston, and to a very fancy opening exhibition, not designed by me, of their paintings. As soon as that show was down, I ran the gallery for a year and a half. I reinstituted the Houston area show that James Sweeney had stopped. Mm-hmm. He had one called the Gulf and Southwest show, I think, that James Brooks was a juror and Calder were a juror. Dick was in that. I can't remember who else from locally was
in
that.
Did Bill Robinson follow you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the first paid director. I did that for a year and a half without pay, which was starting from zero. We didn't have much of a mailing list. We had to get everything printed up. The person that helped me the most in this time was Tony Beecham. We bonded. She came halfway through the year and she said, "I think you need help." And I said, "Please." So she helped me as gallery secretary. She had been in a class of mine before. Well, I started with just what I had to work with. We had a budget of $14,000 for the year, out of which we had to pay Mike Medico, who died just 2 years ago, for being a guard, part-time guard and helpmate.
Mm-hmm.
And then with my students, I went around and picked up work and did installations. The first show that we had was a large Michael Tracy show. This was not untoward. He had already had a major show at the McNay Museum in San Antonio, mm-hmm. and the second exhibition ever held at the new Corpus Christi Museum of South Texas in the Philip Johnson building. And so I gave him the entire building to use. And there still exist slides of that show, which is a very exciting and beautiful show. Ann Holmes wrote a whole column on it. I think that show, which was up just over a month, had close to 2,000 people to come to see it, which was unheard of. There was Michael's big book called The Basic, which he wrote one summer in Corpus Christi. People would stand and read it. Kids would stand and read it. You know, he had these huge hand-painted and written pages of text. And then I finished up with a show of another former student of mine, Hayden Larson, and his teacher, Bill Walsh, both of whom had left Art and Austin to join Hare Krishna in India. Bill Walsh is still in Krishna in India. Hayden is still in Krishna in now in Florida. The thing I found right away about Houston is that the people in our community were very generous, and they would bring you in and they would introduce you around. They would introduce you to collect their friends who were collectors. Everyone knew each other. It was not uncommon to have the simplest little coffee party or cocktail party or after the museum or something and have both James Sweeney and Jerry McCaggie in this house at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not an unusual thing, as well as all the most interesting kinds of people that you would want to see together and talking freely about what you were doing and what other people were doing. It was really very exciting. It reminded me a little bit of what I guess bright young geologists or engineers would come to town, and they would get a connection with someone up in Humble or Shell,
and
let's come out. We're going to go out to the ranch for the weekend, and we're going to and introduce you to everybody you need to know.
Mm-hmm.
And so all it's up to you to just sort of like say hello and do your job and do it well, and they will support
and
you.
And go for it.
And go for it, exactly. The finishing up at the Blaffer Gallery and those shows that I did there, I did a lot of shows, the Houston area shows I started again. And I think the first prize winners in the first Houston area show, first prize went to Pat Colville.
Mm-hmm.
Second prize went to Earl Staley. Third prize went to Joe Tate. And then there were four honorable mentions. We didn't have any money. Nina Cullinan gave us $1,000 for the first prize. I couldn't raise. I've never been good at raising money. I mean, I always told people at the museum when I was trustee there that don't give me any of those cards. I can't ask anyone for money. I can't ask anyone for a favor. I've never been able to. I finished up those shows. We had the small budget of $14,000, and the vice president, Pat Nicholson's office, picked up the parties and the postage.
Mm-hmm.
And Ann and I worked our fingers to the bone to make this work, and it worked. Then we had a national search, and Bill Robinson seemed to be the appropriate person to take it over at that time. And I supported that. And I think he did fine for the next stage. And then it's certainly moved on since that time. And the relationship of the Blaffer family to the gallery has certainly been tenuous, as you know. Very small funds given each year. Patrick Nicholson, I think, made a big mistake in naming it the Blaffer Gallery in the beginning. Mrs. Blaffer did not want it to be named the Blaffer Gallery, but he did it, hoping that he would get more funds from them. At least that's what I understood. I was a few times in Mrs. Blaffer's house. I was much earlier than that. I was many times in T.T.'s house on Wyndon and Jane Owen's house on Pinewald.
Mm-hmm.
And remember distinctly their beautiful paintings there. But all of that was so easy. I mean, I have a day bed here that Miss Ina knew about this day bed. It was made for my great-great-grandfather's house, which she moved from Long Point to Winedale and unfortunately had burned down a few years later. It's at Lauderdale House. But Miss Ina would call me regularly to see if she could buy this day bed off of us because it was made for that house. She filled that house with wonderful Texas furniture,
mm-hmm.
Which all burned up.
Thankfully, you've got yours here.
Yes. So all of these relationships were very free and easy. I, you know, got to know Hazel Ledbetter through Miss Hogg, and a sweeter, lovelier person you'd never want to meet. This was early 60s, and I saw Hazel, and still see her daughter, Sue Bell. I have always loved to live in Houston. I mean, I like the climate, I like the people. I am happy to continue to live here. It's a great place to work. I have been fortunate that I can do my work and show it now in my house. I